You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kate Seeley, Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's panel examining the challenges of combating ISIS in Libya. It's very gratifying to have such a large audience today, given how beautiful the weather is. So thank you very much for your interest. In recent days and weeks, we have seen intense diplomatic and media attention focused on the issue of combating ISIS and al-Qaeda affiliates in Libya. And our expert panel today is going to examine their role in Libya, how they have managed to take control of cities like Sirte, Gaddafi's hometown, and discuss the policy options and efforts to defeat ISIS and al-Qaeda affiliates in this country. On our panel today, we're very fortunate to have with us a diverse group of individuals who are all working hard on this issue. It's a great honor to be joined by the senior Libyan representative in Washington, Wafa Bougegas. And I also want to recognize the U.S. government official on the panel today, Jonathan Weiner, for taking time out of his very busy schedule to join us to share his thoughts. His colleague, John DeRocher, had to be called away into a meeting with Ann Patterson, perhaps on Libya. And, of course, it's always a pleasure to do panels with MEI scholar Charles Lister and Carnegie's Fred Weary. So many thanks to our all-star panel for joining us today and for having a conversation, I'm sure, which will be wide-ranging and highly informative. And, of course, many thanks as well to our moderator, David Mack, who is a Libya expert in his own right. He's going to be introducing the panelists and running the conversation afterwards. David Mack is an MEI scholar and a former vice president of the Middle East Institute. He's a frequent commentator on North African and Gulf affairs. During his diplomatic career, David served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, and before that was a U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and his earlier assignments included stints in Libya and Tunisia, so he knows North Africa well. So, David, I would like to now hand the panel over to you. Thank you very much.
Well, there are so many things we can talk about regarding Libya, but this particular program is going to focus on what the so-called Islamic State is up to in Libya. And although it has wrongfully appropriated the word Islamic and does not perform most functions of a state, I'm going to refer to it by the Arab acronym Daesh. And there are other people who may call it ISIL or ISIS. I won't contradict the President of the United States, who insists on calling it ISIL. But Daesh works for me, and that's what I will call it. Now, Charles Lister is an expert on Daesh and in general on terrorism phenomena represented by groups like al-Qaeda as well as Daesh. And he's also very knowledgeable about other sub-state armed groups that often practice terrorism without coverage very often in the U.S. media. He understands the complexities, and he brings a strong grasp on the theory and practice of terrorism, as illustrated by his recent book on Syria. There are full biographies, I believe, in the sheet that you received. He brings that particular perspective to this panel, and the other panelists have other perspectives which will be useful in forming a composite view of the problem. Fred Weary has wide expertise in political military affairs. He knows Libya well, having served as defense attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Libya and based on numerous trips to the country. He understands the complexities of Libyan armed groups and the foreign military establishments that might be involved at some point in interacting with the Libyan government. Wafa Bougegas is the chargé d'affaires for Libya in Washington. She's shown herself to be an articulate voice for both the Libyan government of national accord and for the Libyan people more broadly. She's a fervent Libyan patriot. She was involved in Libyan civil society efforts against the former Gaddafi regime. She responded to her country's call by accepting senior positions in the Libyan Ministries of Education and Foreign Affairs prior to her current assignment. Jonathan Weiner is Secretary Kerry's special emissary for Libya. He was a key member of Kerry's staff when John Kerry was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. John Kerry brought him over to the State Department, where he performed a number of jobs that might be called thankless because they were really touchy issues. But he showed himself able to apply the very broad principles of U.S. foreign policy to specific circumstances in countries that are important to U.S. national interests. His current assignment as special envoy for Libya has been something he's been doing for 2.5 years. And it has made him very aware of the interests of Libya's Arab, African, and European neighbors in relation to that country, as well as the various cross currents within the Libyan body politic. That's the order on which I'm going to ask our speakers to address issues for about 8 minutes. Then I'll ask a few questions. We may have a little interchange among members of the panel before we open it up to questions from the audience. So we'll start with Charles Lister.
Good afternoon, everyone. David, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Seeing as we only have roughly 8 minutes, I'm going to fly straight into my discussion points. I'm not a Libya expert per se, so I'm going to aim to present a more of a big picture look at how ISIS is operating in Libya, how it has got there, and what it represents as of today. Since ISIS's declaration of a supposed or self-declared caliphate in late June 2014, ISIS as an organization has sought to become a transnational or an international movement. And Libya has become arguably its most important sort of secondary area of operations outside of Syria and Iraq. And it has done so by exploiting Libya's sort of fundamental instability and political failures. I'll lean down, sorry. and it has done so, as I say, by exploiting the political failure, the political vacuum, and the social divisions that have emerged out of Libya since or over the last several years. This is a model of exploiting existing divisions that ISIS used to its own advantage in Syria and Iraq over the last several years. In a sense, ISIS aims to... It aims to enter into areas where there are already extensive and intense divisions within existing power players and existing social structures. If you look at how ISIS entered into Syria, this is exactly the same model how it entered into Syria in 2013. It's exactly the same model that it exploited in the city of Mosul from 2011, 2012, 2013. There's a variety of open source information out there nowadays that talks about how ISIS learnt local dynamics. It learned, it knew all of the tribal leaders. It knew all of their dirty histories. It knew how certain tribes were against other tribes. It knew how certain militias had a certain history, maybe 20, 30 years prior, which it could use to its advantage to play off against another actor. This learning the lay of the land is something that ISIS has been very well practiced in, as I say, in Syria and Iraq, and in arguably it was the key to its entrance and its acquisition of Sirte as it's essentially a de facto capital in Libya today. So what does ISIS represent in Libya today? Estimates in terms of its manpower vary, but arguably it represents between 3 to 6,000 fighters. Some estimates suggest as much as 70% of its manpower in Libya is made up of non-Libyan fighters. Tunisians in particular have turned out to be a very significant recruitment tool for ISIL in Libya, as Tunisians have become extremely significant for ISIS foreign fighter recruitment in Syria and Iraq. Again, there is a lot and there's an extensive amount of open source information existing today describing how Tunisians in particular have actually left ISIL in Syria and Iraq in order to bolster ISIL's presence in Libya. The same has taken place with regards to senior commanders who have been fighting in Syria and Iraq. They have, in the last 12 months, some have, at least half a dozen, been deployed to Libya to bolster ISIL's senior command structures in Libya. So clearly Libya is of strategic importance to ISIL's long-term objectives, particularly considering the organization is coming under pressure in Syria and Iraq. So 3,000 to 6,000 fighters. ISIL controls roughly 200 kilometers of territory along the central band of coastline in Libya, with Sirte in the middle. Operationally, ISIS has a capacity to reach over to the Tunisian border and, as was demonstrated in March this year, across the border into Tunisia, as well as into the capital Tripoli and as far east as Benghazi and further afield. ISIL is currently led by a Saudi, Abdel Qader al-Najdi, in Libya, having previously been led by a very senior ISIL leader, Abu Nabil al-Ambari, who came from Iraq to bolster ISIL's leadership in Libya. ISIL has demonstrated a capacity for very fast growth. I think back in November, the estimate back then was roughly 1,500 to 2,000 fighters were within ISIL's ranks in Libya. And as I say now, the high-end estimate suggests as much as 6,000, although I suspect it's probably 3 or 4. But that's at least a doubling of manpower under its command in the last 6 to 7 months. It operates multiple training camps across the country, including training camps for children. Those are known as Caliphate Cubs camps. Clearly, it's trying to be in Libya for the long haul. Sirte, as I said, is its de facto capital in Libya. It began as an organization infiltrating Sirte back in November 2014, exploiting those kinds of pre-existing social divisions, tribal divisions, political divisions, militia divisions, to its own advantage. Sirte in particular, and I'm sure my esteemed actual Libya expert panelists will be able to talk about this perhaps in more detail than I, but in particular, Sirte was, of course, Muammar Gaddafi's hometown. It was well known to have been an area where some Gaddafi loyalists had gone back to after the fall of the Gaddafi regime. But it was also a town that was essentially under the control of Misratan militias prior to ISIL's entry into the town. ISIL used the fact that there were individuals that other militias accused of being loyal or still loyal to Gaddafi's former cause to its own advantage. And it's many of those individuals who now fight under ISIL's ranks in Libya. You can perhaps use a similar analogy, although it's somewhat more complicated, to talk about how ISIL has exploited Ba'athist and former Saddam-era officials in Iraq bolster its own ranks in Iraq. So those pre-existing divisions, those pre-existing tensions, especially on a political level, it has used to its own advantage. I'll fast forward. I've already had a time warning over a little bit of the detail in terms of governance in Sirte, which suffice to say is extremely harsh. As soon as ISIL took over Sirte, it imposed what it calls a city charter. This is something it did in Raqqa in Syria. This is something it did in Mosul in Iraq. It basically lays out a full law and order approach to how civilians are expected to behave in Sirte as a whole. Women are subject to as many as 7 behavioral and dress code regulations. Men have similar regulations with regards to the length of their trousers. There are 3 prisons were basically established, 3 central prisons, depending on the magnitude of your alleged crimes. A HISBA police or a behavioral police was established, which patrols the streets on a day-to-day basis. Internet is now restricted only to internet cafes run by ISIS. So the acquisition of outside information is particularly restricted unless one is able to travel outside of the city or outside of ISIL areas of control. There is little evidence so far to suggest that ISIS is making significant amounts of money from oil in Libya, but it certainly is taxing civilians in Sirte and elsewhere at significant levels. All of this basically underlines exactly the same model ISIS has used in Syria and Iraq to control through fear populations under its influence. For that reason, and I'll briefly turn to the counter-ISIL efforts or discussions with regards to Libya, I would actually advocate in this current phase, not rushing. I think there is a significant impetus within political discussions these days to rapidly bring the fight to ISIS in Libya through local forces, but also the deployment of special forces from the US, from France, from the UK, and from various other Western countries. ISIL will exploit this unless that force structure that is used in terms of local fighters are sufficiently vetted, trained, equipped, and ready and under a single command. And I don't think we're anywhere near that position as of now. And in that sense, I would advocate a let them rot strategy in the meantime. In a sense, accept the fact that people aren't necessarily happy under ISIL control there. I'm sure there are areas where people are willing to be under ISIL control in the meantime, considering the broader state of chaos. But over time, resentment will continue to grow. This is something we've seen in Syria. This is something we've seen in Iraq. And certainly tribes in places like the Egyptian Sinai are showing similar tendencies. Time should be spent now on, as I'm sure, as I say, my fellow speakers will talk about, better uniting the political structure in Libya after the December 2015 agreement. And most importantly, perhaps of all, uniting the two West and East armed structures, respectively, under the current government that was agreed in December 2015 and under the command of General Haftar in Benghazi in the East. Unless those two forces unite, I can say with pretty significant certainty, ISIL will exploit those two divisions, or certainly it will try to, and it will devote significant resources to doing so. In terms of the influx of weaponry, there is currently a UN embargo on the provision of weaponry to militia forces in Libya. It hasn't done an awful lot of good. Various state actors have been sending in weaponry. Stop. Okay. various outside state actors have been sending in weaponry to Libya throughout that UN arms embargo. There's now a discussion. Secretary Kerry spoke last week in Vienna about finding a way out of that UN's arms embargo in order to send weaponry to vetted, acquired armed forces on the ground. Again, I would urge caution. Until there is a unified armed structure, until the forces have been sufficiently vetted, have been sufficiently trained, and sufficiently linked up with preferably external US, French, British special operations forces, I would hesitate to send in large influxes of weaponry. As a Syria expert, I can certainly say we've learned many lessons from 2011 and 2012 from Syria that should be learnt in a place like Libya today. I'm sure there's plenty more we can discuss in the Q&A, but hopefully I've made some sense while rushing through my notes.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks to the Middle East Institute for the invitation. And wow, what an introduction, or more than an introduction. Hopefully I'll find something new to say, but probably just underscore a lot of the points that were made and sort of illustrate them from some recent trips that I've made to Libya in the West this year and then last year in the East. I think when we look at the Islamic State, we have to sort of understand this fusion between, you know, foreign and indigenous elements, that there's a long legacy of jihadism that the Islamic State builds upon, and that in some sense we're seeing a generational evolution of jihadism in Libya, and these intense debates among jihadists about the nature of the state, the caliphate, the acceptance of governance. These are all being played out over the last two or three years, and the Islamic State, I think, represents the ascendancy of one particular strain, but that's not to say there are other strains of jihadism still pushing back against it. So again, these generations of jihadism, you probably know them, the 1980s, the Muqatila, the post-2001, 2003 generation, and then the post-2011 generation, a younger generation, that was radicalized partly by the Syria war, by going to participate in the Syria jihad. There are obviously key nodes for jihadism, historic nodes for jihadism in Libya that the Islamic State unsurprisingly has tapped into, Derna, Benghazi, Sabratha. And I would argue also that when it arrived in Libya, it found an infrastructure already in place that had been sort of set up by Ansar al-Sharia. And so much of the Islamic State's development has been sort of the flipping or the co-opting of that infrastructure in various places. So what were the catalysts? I think obviously the Syria war was huge. I mean, many Libyans went to Syria after 2011. Some of them not necessarily jihadists. They wanted to just volunteer and fight. Some jihadists, but not Islamic State. Obviously, with the ascendancy of the Islamic State in Syria, some of them defected over to that group. Others came back and then defected to the Islamic State later on. But it was this nucleus of Islamic State Libyan fighters who came back to Libya that I think implanted the organization first in Derna, announcing it in the fall of 2014. Simultaneously, you had the weakening of the old al-Qaeda affiliated groups like Ansar al-Sharia. And part of that, and this is really my next point that for the catalyst, was the political division of Libya into the Dignity Dawn camp that was absolutely fundamental in giving the space for the Islamic State to insert itself, that these factions were so busy fighting each other. They were in some cases cynically using the Islamic State to demonize their opponents, accusing each other of you know, supporting the Islamic State. Meanwhile, the Islamic State is growing. In tandem, you had the Islamic State investing in Libya through emissaries, through advisors. We heard about the leadership of that. Technical advisors, Sharia courts. Many of these are foreign. You also had the foreign fighter influx. The Islamic State made a concerted effort to redirect foreign fighters first in North Africa, but then in general. Don't come to Syria and Iraq, come to Libya. And many of these fighters are the most hardened, the most vicious fighters. When I was in Benghazi with the Libyan army forces there, they said to me that the snipers, the suicide bombers were all foreign that they were facing, Tunisians mostly. And the same thing was said by the Misratans at their checkpoint that has just been retaken. I think when we look at countering the Islamic State, we have to really understand a case-by-case basis, that the Islamic State's roots in Derna are quite different than in Sabratha. And so that requires a tailor-made approach to each of these different areas, and especially Sirte. Derna, obviously, I think its reputation is well known. But again, the key thing there is that it ran up against this barrier of an older generation of al-Qaeda, of Muqatila, that pushed it out, also a tribal element. So the very factionalism, I think, that allows the Islamic State to insert itself into Libya is also a buffer. It also bounds how far the Islamic State can expand. In Benghazi, the Islamic State inserted itself into an Islamist militia insurgency. It flipped many of the Ansar al-Sharia and Libya's Shield members. They defected over to the Islamic State. It enjoyed support from the social fabric of key Benghazi neighborhoods that were under assault by Operation Dignity, and it was bolstered by foreigners coming in from abroad, by boat. In Sirte, the main stronghold, again, here, this is where the original Ansar al-Sharia infrastructure proved so critical. The Ansar al-Sharia went into Sirte, and really played a role in co-opting local tribes and tribal mediation, in flipping some of the pro-Qaddafi tribes that were on the outs, that had faced Misratan discrimination. And indeed, that's what the Islamic State has really played upon, as Charles mentioned. This notion that, you know, you're the losers in the new order, we can protect you. Now, I don't want to say that entire tribes have flipped. You can't say the Qaddafi have come over to ISIS. I mean, it's often very personalized choices, and it's often very, very localized. But some Sirte refugees told me, they had this saying, better the hell of the Islamic State than the paradise of Misrata. In other words, we would rather, you know, tacitly support this draconian group than be subjugated by this town nearby that treated us so poorly after the revolution. Beni Walid, it seems to be a fruitful area next. The Islamic State appears to be moving south of Misrata toward Tripoli, and again, capitalizing on Beni Walid's exclusion and marginalization. In Sabratha, the dynamics there, I think, are more financial. There's smuggling networks. There's families that have had a long time affiliation with jihadism and smuggling. And there's a large foreign component there. I mean, most of it's Tunisians, and so this sort of guest house and training site for foreign volunteers. What's their strategy right now? I would argue it's one of consolidation and disruption, to consolidate their hold on Sirte, to cut off oil revenues and disrupt the formation of a new state. We saw this in attacks on police training. To peel away the losers of the new order. What are the tribes? What are the disgruntled youth that we can peel away? and to shift westward from Sirte through Beni Walid toward Tripoli. Now, the key challenges, I guess I've got, you know, 1 minute. I think Charles outlined them, you know, very well, is the question of partnership. Who does the West ally with? The country is divided. There's no central chain of command, military chain of command. And the great risk that the U.S. and others face is identifying local partners, the risk of working with militias against the Islamic State, that could further fracture the country, reduce the incentives for reconciliation. So counterterrorism must reinforce the long-term building of inclusive governance. There's the enormous challenge of rebuilding the police and the army, and I think the fight against the Islamic State should be a platform to do that. So as I see it, there are three options for going after the Islamic State. There's Western CT direct action plus air power, no involvement by locals. This is untenable. We know this from experience. There has to be a local element. The second option is the West plus local enablers or allies, meaning militias. And the second, this is obviously fraught with risks in terms of what comes next. When you liberate Sirte, what kind of governance replaces this? And the third option is obviously the most desirable, but the one with the longest time horizon, and that is the West supporting a Libyan-led government of national accord effort through a unified military, through a national effort that tackles this menace. And I'll leave it to the next speakers to discuss those dynamics. Thanks.
Special thanks to the Middle East Institute for hosting this panel discussion on a very important topic to my country and to the region. Libya is at a dangerous turning point. And I'm gonna, after we heard the analysis of Daesh from the experts, I'm gonna be talking on a different aspect. I'm gonna talk about what we think is a different perspective on defeating ISIS in Libya, sustainable defeat. Libya today is in deep economic crisis with severe cash shortage and in a desperate need of humanitarian aid and threatened by Islamic State. The chaos in Libya threatens the region and neighboring countries. The chaos originally is the result of domestic complicated political and economical dynamics that resulted in divisions and confrontations between different armed groups across the country. Military intervention or military technical assistance alone will not be enough to defeat ISIS. And I'll elaborate on that, and this is the perspective. Libyans will defeat terrorism only through addressing domestic drivers of instability. The U.S., the international community, should focus on helping Libya on pillars of stabilization, such as the economy, reconciliation between armed groups, and decentralization of powers. The most effective response to the rise of ISIS in Libya is the construction of an accountable Libyan state with an effective security sector. Without an accountable Libyan state, the war against Daesh or other extremist groups will be endless in Libya. This is not to say that nothing can be done against ISIS in Libya in the short term. Quite the opposite. The anti-ISIS fight could strengthen the political process and vice versa. For instance, efforts right now by the Presidential Council to create a military joint command to fight ISIS can both help the security situation and strengthen the political process. Moreover, new Libyan government should be supported to resist threats by militias and help the central bank and government push back against their demands and put constraints on spending on their salaries. Not only that, but according to the political agreement, militias should be dismantled and reintegrated on individual basis, either in civil or military sectors. It's also essential for the government of national accord to reconcile with the forces dominant in eastern Libya, namely the Libyan National Army. The international community should help in devising a proposal for reconciliation. Acknowledging the Libyan National Army's role in defeating terrorist groups in the East and acknowledging the sacrifices of the Libya in the East is paramount to reconciliation. The U.S. and the international community should support Libya through different policy aspects, we see. In terms of priorities, the economic crisis should come first, as failure to resolve the economic crisis will further exacerbate the humanitarian crisis, increase organized crime activities, and promote the growth of ISIS. Second, political reconciliation is crucial to make Libya's institutions work. Third, the U.S. and the international partners should act on regional drivers of chaos in Libya. Acting on these pillars will help address the two most pressing concerns in Libya, namely security and counterterrorism on the one hand and illegal immigrants on the other. The idea is, given Libya's chaos and insecurity, the response of the international community should not be to put security first and focus on supporting government to build its forces and control its borders. This strategy has failed before, and I was witness to that as I was Undersecretary for Political Affairs and responsible for many of the security initiatives offered by many countries around. And since Libya's insecurity is the result of complex interaction between complicated political, economic, and military factors. In conclusion, the U.S. and the international community should not see Libya purely through the lens of counterterrorism and should not take a purely technical approach focused on building capacity, equipment, arming, etc., even though they are important. But in order to achieve tangible results, sustainable results, the partner states should help the new government tackle economic crisis, step up reconciliation, and help develop functioning institutions so it can absorb the support offered by the international community, so it can absorb the training offered, so it can observe whatever is offered by the international community. To grapple with these problems, very high level of political, diplomatic efforts is more important now than ever. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Weiner, the United States Special Envoy for Libya. First of all, there's been an enormous amount of wisdom already expressed. Generally speaking, I agree with pretty much everything, not every word, but close to it, of what's come up, so been discussed so far. We ought not to be too abstract about what we're facing. In the last 72 hours, we saw Misratah forces fighting Daesh to try and regain critical territory between Misratah and Sirte. They grabbed back some critical territory at key pathways, which lead to Tripoli and lead to the south and lead to the east. In return, Daesh equipped a big bus with a vehicle, improvised explosive device, and killed what's been reported as 36 Libyan soldiers, though it was probably more, and there were some 100 people seriously injured who they're trying to now keep alive. This battle in between Libyans and Daesh, and I would differentiate them because Libyans are people who believe in a country. Daesh believes in itself, to the extent that it believes in anything. And it offers a fantasy, an ugly and predatory fantasy vision of gold, glory, God, girls, and guns, which can be attractive to immature men in their teens and 20s, but offer nothing to anybody else for the long run. So this battle is being fought right now. I had written down prior to Wafa saying a word that chaos is the enemy. Daesh is an enemy and a big enemy. But chaos is the enemy, and she kept using that word, because Daesh feeds on chaos. So if you want to get defeat Daesh in Libya, you have to address the factors, as Wafa did in her presentation, that have fed chaos in Libya. And that's where our policy has to be based on at its core. Our broad strategic interest in Libya is to therefore support a unified Libya, not one that gets divided up into parts, with an accountable government, not people self-proclaiming, I control the resources, you got to talk to me if you want anything, because it's me, because I do. That was kind of the way Gaddafi ruled on behalf of the people for 42 years. It didn't work then, and it doesn't work with would-be mini-Gaddafis who want to control particular portions of the country and don't care about the whole. The U.S. strategy to counter Daesh is therefore rooted in the recognition that prolonged political discord in the country has allowed violent extremist groups to proliferate. And not just Daesh. You've had al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. You've got two different Ansar al-Sharia groups, and you've got some other groups. When you have undergoverned space, it's a great opportunity for bad guys to make mischief and for foreigners to come in. Luckily, Libyans don't tend to like foreigners telling them what to do of any kind, whether it's Americans or Brits or French or people from Iraq and Syria. So they develop antibodies right quick. The foreigners telling them what to do, and that's one of the reasons why I am betting on Libya and Libyans to win, not Daesh, whatever its temporary strengths may be. So our approach to counterterrorism is therefore tied very closely to our efforts to support the government of national accord. We think Libyans must be able and need a stable government to close the political and security vacuum, and that is a precondition to effectively combating Daesh and other bad guy groups for the long run. So is it security first or economy first? Well, it's hard to get people to invest in a country when security is a disaster and internationals can't be present. If Washington, D.C. had no internationals present, we would be a much poorer place. If the United States had every foreigner leave, our economy would be in absolute shambles. And we're the United States, big global economic superpower. So having everybody leave Libya has been bad for Libya in terms of foreigners. You've got to get enough security back in that you can get participants in Libya's economy. Now, one of the key things that I learned in talking to people at the IMF about Libya, I said, what reforms can they put in place with a public financial management and good governance and eliminating corruption and getting rid of duplicative salaries and so on and so forth that would make the difference? And he said, there isn't anything you can do in all that territory if you were completely successful if Libya isn't pumping oil, because oil is responsible for 90%+ of government revenues. It's not quite 100, but it's pretty close. And right now they're pumping, 150,000 barrels a day, one-tenth, at a time that a price of oil is one-quarter of what it used to be. 3 minutes. We're not going to be able to get through all four sections. We're in section one. One-tenth at a time the price of oil is one-fourth what it used to be. It doesn't work. They're going to eat up all Libya's seed corn. There's not going to be any seed corn left, and then you have real chaos. So the current economic problems and the security conditions are intimately interlinked, and they're interlinked with the political. So we keep looking at security, what we're going to do about Daesh, and will we continue airstrikes? Well, we've had two so far against terrorists. If you have one, you can have two. If you have two, you can have three. We've done training and equipping of Libyans in the past, or offered it, and done a little of it. We're going to offer more. We secured a successful ministerial communique agreement in Vienna earlier this week. I just came back from there. 22 countries, including every country in the region, all of Libya's neighbors, all of Libya's Mediterranean neighbors, all agreeing on the same things. Integrated, unified government of national accord, exemption from the arms embargo to let that government of national accord take on terrorists, which we support and will probably participate in if the Libyans ask us, and moving ahead to try and build successful national structures. On the economy, clearly there's a liquidity crisis, some of that's hoarding, and we need to get through it. We have to give Libyans hope that there is a future through government and governance. We have to get the next generations of Libyans playing a profoundly significant role in a future Libya, because they have many fewer of the bad habits people developed under Gaddafi. And I see hope as a in connection with incoming generations who have fresh ideas and who, like people everywhere, believe in their own country and want to see a place they can live in. So U.S. policy is founded on the political premise of one government, not multiple governments, compromise, sharing, one political process, not multiple negotiations in multiple places, regional states, anyone who's had clients and proxies, aligning on behalf of a unified government rather than fighting ideological or regional or sectarian battles, and resources being shared on a national level. So whether you're east, west, south, or anything else, you have a stake in the government. Those are pretty core principles. It's very simple in the end from this complicated problem, what your goals are. And if you stick with those principles, you may even be able to begin to make some progress, which I think we are starting to see as the GNA begins to take hold. Thank you.
Okay, my thanks to all of our panelists. And how are you hearing me well in the back there? Okay. I'm going to ask a question of each one of our speakers roughly in the order that they came up here. Then I may ask them to question one another a little bit about some points. But let me start with Charles Lister. Charles, your description of Sirte doesn't make it look like a very fun place for a Libyan to be living. But I wonder, is it a place where Daesh can feel safe? I mean, this is not Raqqa. It's not Mosul. It is a long, it's very, very close to the seaborne air assets of NATO countries. There are these Libyan factions that have been described quite well, I think, by Fred, that that threaten Daesh in one way or another. Do they really see this as a place where they can build a caliphate long term?
Honest answer is I'm not convinced, but it's the best bet they've got for now. It was the best opportunity they had from late 2014 into 2015 to acquire a solid territorial foothold with links further and, you know, elsewhere along the coast and further south. As I said throughout my presentation, I'm not enough of a Libya expert to say everything definitively, but from what I can see, they've made attempts to go further south. I think for sure in terms of recruitment, there is indications that they're acquiring foreign fighters, not just through Tunisia, but also from more on the, you know, further in the African continent. So I think Sirte is going to be their bastion. I have fairly little doubt that there will be a fight for the city at some point. And ISIL, knowing how they operate elsewhere and knowing the fact that they appear to be being led in Sirte by commanders who have come from Syria and Iraq, they will seek to sow as many divisions as they can within tribes, within rival militias, within other communities, so as to prolong their control of Sirte and its surrounding areas for as long as possible. Then, of course, what happens after that, we have to wait and see. I don't think it's a coincidence that ISIS has demonstrated in March this year its capacity to spill over into Tunisia. I don't think it's a coincidence that we've seen ISIS slow down or reduce the amount of kind of mass executions that they've carried out. You know, Human Rights Watch released a report recently which said that they've documented, I think, 49 executions in Sirte. It's actually quite a low number for ISIS, believe it or not. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we've seen that relatively low number, because I think, as you suggest, they probably are aware of the potential dangers they have there coming into the future. If they feel under pressure, we will see more killings. We will see more spectacular attacks. Probably oil industry further south may come under attack, and we'll see more mass executions. But I don't think we're there yet. Right now, we are in that city-building effort, not necessarily a caliphate, but we are in that city-building effort that we've seen replicated elsewhere in Egypt, in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere.
Fred, let me ask you to pick up on that. How successful do you think Daesh can be in building the kind of quasi-state structures there that it has in Turkey and in Syria. After all, there's got to be a lot of competition, not only from other Libyan factions, but from this new government of national accord. And I just question how much in the way of financial reserves Daesh could bring to bear in trying to attract Libyans and other fighters. I realize there's a big reservoir of potential fighters elsewhere in Africa, in Tunisia, and so on. But what are the practical constraints on Daesh, and how would it be possible for the combination of the Libyan government of national accord and international partners to compete with them?
Sorry, you've answered it. I mean, they're not able to really replicate the sort of state building functions that they have elsewhere because they lack, you know, revenue streams. They're not able to tap into vast swaths of sectarian disenchantment. There's sort of these isolated pockets where they've implanted themselves. But as I mentioned, I mean, they've been pushed out of Derna. It's sort of very, you know, episodic. So I do think, as I mentioned, this sort of atomization of Libya that has allowed them to come in is also a buffer in the sense that they run up against rival militias, against rival towns wherever they go. But again, I think it's the lack of will and capacity of these factions that have allowed them to grow. So they're still capable of great disruption. They should not be taken lightly. They can plot attacks abroad. They are, as Jonathan mentioned, the attack on Misrata was really a preemptive. I mean, I think they saw something coming, and it's been quite violent, and a lot of people have, you know, lost their lives. The question about, what can the GNA do? I mean, again, this goes to the question of inclusive governance as the antidote. I mean, you know, the security solution will only get you so far. Something has to come after ISIS. It has to be inclusive. There has to be the return of displaced. There has to be rule of law. I mean, we don't want to just substitute one extremist threat for another. And so there are reasons that extremism has flourished in these particular locales. So again, I think it's absolutely critical that we proceed, you know, cautiously and methodically. So.
Well, that said, Fred, if things continue to stagnate in terms of reestablishing stability in Libya, and if, as the weather improves in the Mediterranean, we have another wave of people coming across the Mediterranean toward Europe, desperate refugees, with all the potential for terrorists coming along with them, which countries would be most critical to Western military efforts to bolster the Libyan government in dealing with these kind of security problems? Which countries feel most threatened, and which countries are likely to come forward with some kind of military assets if things deteriorated to that extent?
Well, again, I think you've sort of answered it. I mean, the European countries that are affected, they have announced their willingness. I mean, the Italians have been, I think, crucial to this. They've somewhat backed off from participating in a stabilization force, but I do believe they've committed to training. The British and the French reportedly have their forces already on the ground, and I think they would be critical to lending expertise now. So again, I think there's a huge will among the European powers, and it's a matter, I think, of coordinating those efforts, and especially on the soft fight. I mean, this is really crucial, so that the soft interactions are not working at cross purposes, and then just, you know, making sure that countries that have certain capabilities to contribute. I mean, like the Italians have a very strong sort of constabulary police training mission that I think could be very beneficial to what Libya needs. The U.S. has certain capabilities, but we really need to learn the lessons of our past training failures that were alluded to, where we did the training before there was anything to absorb the trainees. I mean, there was no unified government, there was no bureaucracy, so you train a bunch of soldiers, but then what do they come back to? They become militias. And also making sure you train a military that is representative of all of Libya's factions, that you're not just training one particular town or tribe. So.
Yeah, but surely you're not suggesting that we just dump some military equipment in there on this nascent armed forces of the new unified Libyan government and expect them to be able to use it without significant training measures.
Did I say that or what?
No, but that's my question. How much training is going to be required for the forces loyal to the new Libyan government for them to absorb military?
Well, purposes? I mean, I'm not, you might ask the U.S. representative. Look, I mean, we know from past experiences, how long does it take to create a military from a fractured country? I mean, it took us, how well did we do in Iraq? When you train a counterterrorism force, there are certain, you know, there, again, it goes to this question of, it's not simply a technical capacity. You can train them. You can train them to certain technical standards, but you've got to have, you know, political unity. And so, I mean, it's a long horizon. I think we're looking at a very long time. We've got this immediate ISIS threat, but again, we need to be looking at the long game in terms of how do we rebuild the military. It's going to take a long time. So.
Okay, let me follow up on that with you, Wafa. The governments that were represented in Vienna have indicated support for lifting the arms embargo on sales of military equipment to the government. Assuming that gets through the UN Security Council, and my understanding is it will take a UN Security Council vote, don't know what Russia might do at this stage, but assuming that there is a UN Security Council resolution, is your government also going to request specific assistance in terms of training its forces? And how would that be organized? And where? Would it be on Libyan territory? Would it be in Tunisia or Egypt? I don't quite understand how you form up the armed forces for the new Libyan government starting from where you are now.
Thanks. It's not an easy question. Let me tell you something. Let me go back to an initiative that was done by couple of countries, among them the U.S. and a few European countries, where they had proposed to train some Libyan soldiers. It was after the G8 summit 2013. They made a proposal to, it was the general purpose force, and the idea was to create a nucleus of a national army. The idea was to train them abroad. We failed big time because the vetting was inappropriate. The young people were taken to different countries. And certainly there was one critical thing where you have different schools of military, and that was amazing, because how can you train a military by 6-7 schools and you expect the soldiers to come back? But anyways, it failed because the vetting failed. And the reason was we did not have a proper strong institution for vetting. The government was creating committees to vet to I don't know what parallel institutions to the existing weak, fragile defense ministry. Right now, let me tell you, We have a nucleus of an army. We have a lot of military professionals all over the country, south, west, and east. We have many different ranks. I mean, the military institution existed during Gaddafi time. It was just like any other fragile institution in the country. We had big, massive military capacity, as you know, during the revolution, camps were opened and everything. I think the country had a huge, massive amount of arms. Those officials, those military ranks are available. They are there. The idea is to gather them, and I think this is what's starting to happen. I mean, I know the Government of National Accord is already working with these people in Tripoli. The same in the East. I mean, the Libyan National Army composes of these people regardless. I mean, sometimes, yes, they had recruited civilians, and yes, the war was tough, and yes, it's a street kind of fight. It's not traditional military fight. You have to realize that fighting terrorism is not a traditional classic military confrontation or something. Very complicated and very devastating, because it should depend on intelligence, on special forces, special operations, and not military by the means of heavy artillery and this stuff. To sum that up, I think we do have the nucleus of the army in Libya. We have a huge number of trained soldiers, young soldiers in many different towns in the West. Gaddafi had trained many, and now we are in a period where these people are technocrats. I mean, they have not, their hands are not looted with blood, and they should come back, and they're already there. And building on that, we should build on it. We should build their capacity further, and as far as you're saying with lifting the arms embargo, we have to be very careful here, because we just need to assess what we have already. We need to make sure that it's in the right hands, it's falling in the right hands. We need to solve the problem of the militias, and I spoke about that earlier. The government has to be supported to resist their pressures and their desire to continue. I mean, we don't want to go back in a circle and go back to square one, a country of militias, of militias, of militias. We need to convince these young people. And I wished many times that this will be in one of our resolutions, one of the UN Security Council resolutions, that it's the duty of the Government of National Accord and the international community to support us on that. They should be given incentives. DDR programs should be starting in parallel. And only at that point we can see a proper army being formed and assessing what we have and what is needed. And I think the Government of National Accord will be prepared at that point, once there is a reconciliation between the armed groups across the country, will be prepared to make its proper requests.
Wow, thank you for that, Wafa. And I want to apologize for jumping over the very, I think, well-considered order in which you presented the issues that this government has to face. You said it, you said in your prepared remarks, of course, that security couldn't come first, that you had to start with getting the economy going, having political reconciliation, and you specified reconciliation of the Government of National Accord with the Libyan National Army in the East. So I want to recognize that you have a kind of a well-thought-out approach to that, and I didn't mean to distort your views by getting you on to the military preparedness and rebuilding the military topic, but you did that extremely well. Thank you. Jonathan, I want to come to you last here, noting that some of the things we indicated, the U.S. government indicated following what seems to me to have been a very successful meeting in Vienna, was that we were going to be prepared to be quite forthcoming in support of a wide range of support for the Libyan Government of National Accord, in effect saying that if they would form themselves up as a partner, we would be there to partner with them. But I really wonder to what degree this is going to have the necessary level of support from the Congress of the United States, which hasn't shown itself to be notably enthusiastic sometimes for all the things that need to be done. To what extent do we need to build more support within the United States? And particularly, even though there were, as you noted, all the governments in the region signed on in Vienna. In the past, it's been my impression that we haven't had wholehearted support for the idea of the international community getting behind a single government. And I wonder to what degree this issue needs to be higher on the agenda of our relations with Egypt, for example, in terms of making certain that the international community carries out the kind of high-minded pledges that it made in Vienna.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Mack. We were talking with Egypt about Libya all week this week, probably most of last week, and probably much of the week before. You know, you forget when you continue to have conversation after conversation with one another. Getting alignment among all of the regional players, all of the neighbors and regional players, as well as the European neighbors, has been at the core of our policy for the past several years. Libya can't afford to get divided up by people with different interests, fighting with one another. That's part of what leads to the chaos. If you've got one regional state supporting one player and a different regional state supporting a different player, that's just not going to work very well for Libya. And I think everybody understands that. Egypt, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Chad, Niger, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco. I hope I've not missed any of the North African and regional players. Jordan, I did miss one, as well as United Kingdom, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, European Union, Arab League, African Union, all signed on to this communique, which is a full-throated endorsement to the Government of National Accord. The way I think about it, it's a bit like water hydraulics. I don't know if there are other kinds of hydraulics, probably are with other fluids. You know, you can't predict where an individual particle is going to go when water is flowing through something turbulent. That's the core of chaos theory, right? But if you dig a trench, you know most of the water is going to go down that trench. And if you turn into a channel, more of the water is going in. And then you, after you dig the channel, you then coat the channel and you then start putting in filters and a variety of things to get that water to be looking good and useful for more purposes. So what we're doing with the Government of National Accord is we're trying to create a channel for national unity and reconciliation and for building the institutions Libya needs, for building enough stability so that the economy can come back, they can pump oil, which Libya needs for Libyans, distribute the wealth fairly, equitably, in a way that brings people in, and take advantage of Libya's natural resources to rebuild the country. That's what we're trying to do. And I think we've made a lot of progress. There are still a lot of problems, but we're making progress. And the more progress we make, the more Libya will be able to take on Daesh as the vast, 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 vast majority of Libyans want to do and push it, reduce it, and then push it out. It's happening already. You see fighting against them in Derna. You see fighting against them from Misrata. You see fighting against them in Benghazi. It's not like nothing is happening to push them back. They have less territory today than they did 6 months or a year ago, and they're going to have less territory again. This is not a native phenomenon. It is a Iraqi-Syria phenomenon that's being transplanted into Libya, which was welcomed in by some native extremist elements, some of whom then said, we don't want them. You had extremists in Derna for a long time. They didn't like being told what to do by foreign extremists and kicked them out. So the Libyans are difficult. Sharjeh Bougegas is not difficult. She's very sensible and dynamic and easy to work with. We love working with her. But Libyans overall can be quite fractious. So carving that channel in a way that's going to be good, that they're going to say this is good, is what we're trying to do, even if we can't predict where individual droplets are going to go. And if it's going to, and even though it's going to take time, which it is, and it will. Thank you.
Oh, yes. I'll be willing to take some questions from the audience. So, raise your hands. I've already seen, a few of you with your hands up. I suspect there'll be more questioners than I'm able to get to. When I call on somebody, would you, number one, introduce yourself as to your name and affiliation? Number two, ask a question. Don't make a statement. Keep it short. End with a question mark. All right. Let me start in the middle there. Jason. And wait till you get the microphone, please.
Well, always a pleasure to hear such an all-star panel, but particularly to take instructions from a good old friend, Ambassador Mack. So I'm Jason Pack, founder of EyeOnISISInLibya.com. And I agree with the broad outlines of the panel. ISIS is no doubt a symptom of the maladies of Libya's implosion post-2011 and not the cause. And of course, as Charles started off saying and Fred commented, without a bona fide anti-ISIS coalition, it will be impossible to make real gains or sustainable gains in CERT. So my question is, in a way, following up on David's last comment, those actors who support other factions, such as General Haftar in the East or others who don't want to be a part of this anti-ISIS coalition, it's all well and good to sign communiques. What can be done by the international community to incentivize concretely, I think, sanctions and pressure on other areas are crucial. So what are concrete proposals, and I ask this to the whole panel, that can make people fall into line, both regional actors and different militias on the ground, to march into the channel that you've described?
Jonathan, let me ask you to start by addressing that, and then I'll ask other members of the panel to jump in if they have particular comments.
Well, to start with sanctions. Sanctions, of course, are intended to respond to global and national security threats of various kinds, and they have to be legally justified. We've sanctioned the Speaker of the Parliament of the government in Libya we recognized prior to the GNA, after he undertook a series of activities to prevent people from voting, which included substantial threats of violence and intimidation when a majority was ready to support the government of national accord, not just a majority but a supermajority. Over 100 out of 150 roughly participating members were ready to go, and he prevented it from happening. We sanctioned him. We sanctioned Khalifa Gwail, who threatened essentially to imprison or inflict violence on anyone who participated in the government of national accord's entry into Tripoli. After Gwail got sanctioned, he wound up leaving town. He lost protection. He lost financial resources. The central bank channeled all of its authority to the government of national accord and ceased responding to requests from either of the vestigial legacy governments. So that was a very profound economic shift, which I'm sure had its impact. Now, recently there was an effort to sell oil illicitly by the self-proclaimed Eastern National Oil Company, self-proclaimed because it was supported by Aguila's House of Representatives, but not responding to the Government of National Accord. We got a designation by the UN to declare the oil seizable. And the government of India, it was an Indian-flagged vessel, called the ship's captain up and said, turn the vessel around. The ship's captain cooperated. The oil was unloaded, and the oil was no longer susceptible to diversion. We were very grateful, collectively, all of us, to the Indian government for its willingness to help on something that's well outside the area of South Asia. Global responsibility. We had a unified global approach. All UN Security Council members said yes. And not just the typical three, but the full five, fully cooperated with one another, just as Russia and China participated, and I should have mentioned that, participated in the Vienna communique. Very important to have all five on board and to have all five feeling that they're pulling together on behalf of the same goals. So I mentioned Egypt before. We work very, very hard to try and consult with Russia and China as we go along. Here, Russia had some complaints about how all of this came to be. Without going into all of that history, it's worth noting that they have them, and that alignment there is tremendously important too. So after that, what happened next? Did the Eastern NOC say they were going to continue to move oil out because they had every right to? They sure did. And then they heard there was a possibility that the participants in doing that might wind up getting sanctioned as well, not just the oil but the individuals. I don't know whether that had an impact on them or not. I do know that there was a deal cut in the last 48 hours between the Eastern NOC and the Western NOC. And if the Eastern NOC agrees to the Government of National Accord's authority, and the Government of National Accord says they're part of the NOC, then they are. So there's reconciliation, integration, and action with a mixture of sanctions and reconciliation. Do we want to sanction anybody? We don't want to sanction anybody. We don't want Libyans to have to be told what to do by us or anybody else. But if they're not coming together and unifying, you have to continue to carve that channel. So that's how to use sanctions. It's as a signaling device and a tool to try and get people in the right territory and then to back off whenever you can. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's get a microphone to the gentleman over here.
Daniel, sir, we're from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Jonathan, you just answered part of my question, which is, to what degree does the GNA control things at present? The oil company, the investment authority, the central bank, to what degree has any progress been made on unifying the parliaments? Where are we in this process? Oh, and I would add, to what degree is there a connection between the GNA and the local governments that still exist?
Yes.
Okay, very good. It's a work in progress, of course. The central bank that controls all of the foreign exchange, all of it, that's been based in Tripoli, exists under, at this point, the authority of the GNA and undertakes no activities that aren't in alignment with the policies and approach of the GNA. Central banks have some independence, but it's still aligned. The role of the one to the east is still hard to assess. I was very disturbed last week when I read in the Wall Street Journal that they were intending to hire a safe cracker to break into a safe in Benghazi and take out Gaddafi-era gold coins with Gaddafi's visage on them and melt the coins down so no one could see that it was Gaddafi's face, because that reduces the value of the coins in Libya, even if it would increase the value to coin collectors. I thought that was very disturbing. I thought only criminals broke into central bank safes, and that kind of thing only happened in movies. But here it was being discussed in Libya right now by somebody who purports to be a central bank governor. Very disturbing. Reports of large amounts of currency being printed to be imported into Libya. I don't know whether those are true or not. Very disturbing. It's a work in progress. Libyan Investment Authority has said we support and back the GNA, and most of their money is tied up still anyway, which is a good thing in light of Libya's instability. The National Oil Company we just discussed. So it's a work in progress. It's a channel being carved, as it were. In terms of the localities, the Government of National Accord's ability to directly control things is quite limited, but most towns and cities in the United States don't take their direction from President Obama or Vice President Biden. They go about their work under existing arrangements. Very few of us take guidance from the top officers of our country. The system kind of works. So the question is, who's exercising authority and jurisdiction where? And as I've said twice, I'll say it a third time and try not to repeat a fourth time, it's a work in progress and very hard to say. But if people agree to accept the authority of something, then that authority is accepted. So the process is as much a state of mind and a political one as it is anything else. What has to happen over the next few weeks is the Government of National Accord has to use its authority very wisely, working with the central bank in particular, to secure sufficient liquidity to get resources on the ground, currency on the ground, and purchasing power through things like letters of credit to get goods imported, so that there's enough stuff in Libya through Ramadan so people feel, yeah, our needs are being taken care of properly. This is what I believe Chargé Bougegas was referring to before. That is the most important immediate thing they have to do, and they're working on it. And I hear from some people that there's going to be real progress over the next couple of weeks, just in time, and other people who are tearing their hair out and saying it's not going to be enough and we need more emergency measures. But are they focused on it? Yes. And is it critical, as Chargé Bougegas says? It's absolutely essential. Thank you.
That's been a great discussion by a couple of our speakers about couscous and sanctions, which I appreciate. I'm going to ask to get one more question out here at least.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm Eric Goldstein from Human Rights Watch. Of course, ISIS is awful, but since 2011, the various militia have probably been responsible for far more abuses. If there is, those who are talking about a selective lifting of the arms embargo, assure us that there will be vetting. I'd like to hear from any member of the panel who can explain how the vetting will be credible, who's going to do it, who has the intelligence to ensure that the arms don't go into the wrong hands. Thank you.
Well, Wafa Boghaghas was involved with civil society in Libya before, and I think she's in a great position to answer this question.
Civil society. I will answer it maybe with my capacity also as I said, Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs before this post. Now, this is what I mentioned earlier. I said we should not rush, and it's not as simple as that. And we have to be cautious. And I reiterated that. I mean, the idea of lifting arms embargo and just importing arms right now, we need to assess what we have. We need to assess our legitimate, you know, forces that are going to use that. We need to make sure that we have to make sure it's not going to fall in other hands. And I think my colleagues here also agree with me. And I heard Mr. Wary mention this. We should not rush into such an issue yet. We need to organize ourselves, and we need to know who's going to take what, where is it going to go. And I pointed out that previously we had a huge amount of arms, and there is a lot of smuggling. There is a lot of organized crime, smuggling arms, selling arms in the country. Beside ISIS, you know, we have a huge organized crime network in the country, and huge amounts of arms going in and out. So we need to be cautious, definitely. I mean, and I think this is what's going to happen. Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to take, let me take one more question from the lady in the middle, and then I'm going to ask all four members of the panel to leave us with a final thought in one or two sentences what the takeaway from the program should be in their mind. Go ahead, ma'am.
My name is Amanda Cadlick. I'm with RAND. Can you hear me now? Is that good? Okay. My name is Amanda Cadlick. I'm with RAND. My question is about coordination among international actors, sort of carrying on from what Jason said about, you know, a communique is nice, but beyond that, there needs to be some sort of, concrete measure. How do you see coordination among U.S. allies like Italy, France, the U.K.? Because from what it seems is that each actor or each country has its own plan in place for what it's doing on the ground in terms of special forces operations and relationship building. So what is the degree of communication among those actors that you see? And are they communicating in terms of intelligence, sharing? Do they have individual relationships that are different with different militias on the ground? And then from there, do you trust that the GNA is actually a body that will provide the kind of factual information that you're looking for in terms of which militias to trust and which militias to work with?
Let me start with Fred in answering that question.
I'll take the last part of that. I mean, factual information. I mean, this is the real problem, is that, you know, a lot of these militias are sort of auditioning. They're raising their hands saying, yeah, I'll fight ISIS, you know, help me. And they figured out it's a great way to get, you know, support. And the sort of question about, well, what does that really mean? And so is there a criteria for signing up? And, you know, that goes also to the human rights vetting, which is tremendously problematic. In the past, I think when the Europeans and Turkey tried to train the general purpose force, they you know, the record keeping system in Libya was quite sparse. So you didn't know who's a criminal. Some people talk to tribes, you know, ask around the families, is this a good person or a bad person? I mean, it's all very hazy, and it's worrisome. I mean, some of the actors that are pushing back against the Islamic State right now are running their own prisons. I went into one of them in Tripoli where guys are being thrown in there. Who's ISIS? Who's not? Okay, so how do you know he's ISIS? And so the question of due process is really, really an issue. The issue of coordination among special forces, I don't know. I've seen the reports about what the French did in Benghazi, and so each actor has its own impulse and own, you know, agendas. And I think it can be detrimental to national cohesion if it's not orchestrated. I guess that would be my point, that they have to be on the same sheet, because when you back faction A, it creates a certain ripple effect that could be damaging down the road. And so that just goes to my point that this has to be all on the same sheet. And we have to proceed with caution. And that would be my sort of closing point, if I can bring it in early, is first do no harm. You know, let's be very careful before we rush in. This is a society that is probably more resilient than we think. People I talk to, they want their lifestyle issues addressed. They want their economy. And so I think that has to be the first step.
Okay. That's a good way for you to end, Fred, yeah. And I appreciate it. First do no harm. Charles, how about you?
Two things I'd probably want to mention. I think it's been said already that ISIS is not necessarily a Libyan phenomenon, and I think that's absolutely right. That would spark me to say what I always say when I'm talking about Syria is don't forget about the other one, which is Al-Qaeda. And I think Ansar al-Sharia in particular has had a foothold in Libya for much longer than ISIS has. Ansar al-Sharia's main Libyan branch is intensely connected to Al-Qaeda's central leaderships, both in the region and further afield. I think last year there was a conference held between basically every single Al-Qaeda-linked group in North Africa and all the way as far south as Mali in Benghazi, and that was coordinated by Ansar al-Sharia. Talking in an ISIS panel, I will say, don't forget about the other jihadi enemy, which I would say has much more of a historical foothold in parts of Libya. The second point on train and equip, if I was, as someone who works on Syria, to say there is a parallel, the train and equip mission in Syria that is best known is the CENTCOM one, which spectacularly failed. That failed because there was a refusal to understand and acknowledge the reality of local dynamics, the reality of what people's priorities were. So if I was to draw a parallel to Libya, I would say don't make any train and equip mission only about ISIS. The whole broader long-term context of Libya has to be taken into account. And secondly, by extension, the train and equip mission that has worked in Syria, or I would argue has worked, is the one managed by the Central Intelligence Agency and coordinated with regional governments. That took 18 months to find the first genuinely reliable vetted forces. That still exists to this day. Over 50 armed groups have received that vetting, training and equipping process since 2012, 2013. And two out of 53 on my count don't exist anymore. That's a remarkable success rate, but it does go to show how long it takes to conduct a process like this, and how important that process was in succeeding in actually acknowledging the local dynamics. That was the primary reason for its success. So again, to sort of reiterate, I think what I said and others have said, it takes time. Don't rush a process like this. If you rush it, it will fail.
Wafa, would you like to just leave us with a couple of final thoughts?
Yeah, just one thought. We recognize that the process of unifying the whole of Libya and securing it is going to be a long process, and the situation will probably still get worse before it gets better. But my message here is for the international community, for the U.S. government, with gratitude for their high diplomatic and political efforts so far, and to Jonathan in particular, who's been doing a lot of traveling and a lot of hard work, and we communicate sometimes around the day and around the hour. But my message is for them to maintain the momentum and help in coordinating efforts for reconciliation. We need more and more and more reconciliation. We need to, invent proposals and initiatives, and that will be the key for unifying Libya and for reaching peace. Thank you.
Jonathan.
Thank you. I know it would be much better for me to wait until President Clinton or President Trump takes over and leave them with a Libyan problem and divest myself of it. That would definitely be better for my physical and psychological well-being. There's no doubt of it. I'm not convinced, however, that it would be better for Libya to just wait, including on the issues we've talked about. Don't do things until you know what the results are going to be. be very, very, very afraid, not just very, very careful. Sure. I love omelets. I need omelets. I hate breaking eggs. I won't let you break eggs. I don't like egg beaters. It's not a very satisfactory set of formulations. Daesh is killing people in Libya today. It's going to kill a lot more people before it's done. It will kill lots more than that and destroy the lives of lots more of that if you just let them be. Libyans will fight back against them, but they have been asking for, East and West and South, different types of help. Should the United States and other members of the international community, a phrase I hate, respond to them positively or ignore them and say, no, we'll wait for President Clinton or President Trump? I said Clump. That was not a Freudian slip. It was just a mispronunciation. We're faced with the policy choices that we're faced with. Don't underestimate, and this is my last point, the power of communiques. They set norms. They establish norms, and you can then measure conduct against norms and build activities based upon norms that have been set. And underestimating the power of a communique is, I think, a mistake, particularly if people are determined to use it. Thank you.
And let me just say one thing as the moderator and somebody who's been involved in Libya since I went there as a young diplomat in 1969. The whole history of U.S.-Libyan relations is one of some very rather brief periods of very intense involvement, often violent. Our war against Tripoli in the beginning of the 19th century, our bombing of Tripoli and Benghazi in 1986, but also some brief periods of very benevolent involvement, helping Libya become an independent country after the Second World War, when other people would have just turned them back to the Italians. And also the role of American oil companies in helping Libya become prosperous after it had been one of the poorest countries in the world. But basically, if you look at the whole history, it's been long, long periods of neglect. And I hope we are turning that around now and that we will be more closely involved in helping the Libyans have the kind of future that they deserve. And please join me in thanking our four panelists.